Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Learning Pod Network, brought to you by Impact Connections, where we'll be taking a deep dive into the new world of learning pods that are driving educational innovation around the world. I'm your host, Steve Eno. The world has been changed forever by COVID-19. Right now, families and schools around the country are trying to figure out the best way forward without much support. That is why we have created the Impact Connections Learning Pod Network. We believe small group learning, driven by family needs and supported through a network of strong relationships, can improve education for everyone in this moment and beyond. On this podcast, we'll bring you advice from innovative educators and experts to help you create the best learning experience possible. To stay up to date with our latest tools and offerings, please check out our website at www.impactconnections.org. Hi, everyone. Today we have an amazing guest who I had an absolute blast talking to, a former colleague of mine, Nick Valente, who is the most passionate mathematician that I have ever met and an amazing educator who gives great insights for teachers and parents alike on how we can inspire kids to love mathematics and continue to grow on a daily basis. And so please listen to the whole episode. It's a bit longer than normal because Nick is such a deep thinker and such an eloquent speaker that we got into a lot of details that I'm super glad we captured. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to reach out to me. My email, steven@impactconnections.org, because we are always trying to get better and improve the information that we give you, as well as the products that we prepare to help everyone learn and grow during these challenging times. I hope all is well and enjoy the episode. I figured a good place to start would be to hear a little bit about how you got into teaching and just your background a little bit, and then we can go from there.
Yeah, sure. That's a good question, because honestly, the teaching was not something I thought I would get into when I was even in college or anything. So it was sort of a thing that I got into as a let's see what happens kind of thing, as opposed to this is something that I've been wanting to do for a long time kind of thing. And I guess I got my start in teaching through tutoring, basically. I worked, after I graduated college, I started working at Mathnasium, which is a math learning center. And it's a bit of a kind of, not exactly tutoring as most people know it. It's this sort of like hybrid kind of tutoring, somewhere in between classroom teaching and one-on-one tutoring. And it was really the first time I actually thought about pedagogy as a thing. I never thought about how to teach, really. You know, I always liked talking about math to people, and it just because I love it so much. And I just like to share the things that I'm interested in. And as you know, Steve, I'd like to, you know, talk to anyone who's willing to listen about math. And that goes back to when I was a kid. You know, I was always just, whatever it was that I was excited about, video games, I just love to tell other people about it. And anyone who's interested in, you know, that was just how I always was. And then as I, you know, started to get older and, you know, started to kind of realize my own talents in math, it became a really cool experience to kind of help people understand things that they didn't think were accessible to them. And I really got a lot out of that light bulb moment when I would just, and it just started casually, just talking with friends and whatnot. And, you know, kind of realizing that, hey, I can actually get other people excited about math, just the way I would explain things to them. And so that's what kind of got me into tutoring in the first place, why I thought that Mathnasium might be a good fit. Because I'm like, oh, you know, might as well get paid to, if I'm going to blab about math all the time anyway, might as well get a paycheck for it. So that was that. And I started working in Mathnasium. And even then, I wasn't entirely convinced that I was going to be a classroom teacher at any point. You know, just out of college, I was still really figuring out what I was going to do with my life. And even after grad school, the first thing out of grad school I did was I went into publishing. I worked for Springer in the Burkhoeser imprint, and I worked as a publishing editor for about a year and a half. And that I ended up deciding to leave that part mainly because of the commute. I was commuting over 5 hours a day to that job. Wow. So yeah, that was pretty crazy. So, you know, I got to a point, I'm like, oh man, I don't know if I could do this anymore. The job was cool, but you know, so I just started to look for other employment that was, you know, a little bit more manageable from the commuting side. And so I just decided, I was looking, you know, what else could I do? Publishing, unfortunately, was very heavily based in lower Manhattan. So other publishing jobs would have just been two blocks over. So I was like, oh boy, all right, other publishing jobs would just give me the same problem. I don't really know what else to do. So I started kind of just getting creative. I was like, what on earth else could my background allow me to do? And so private school teaching was one of those options on the table, just because you don't need a teaching certificate. I didn't go to school for teaching, so I couldn't be a public school teacher without like going through the certification process. I don't have a PhD, so I couldn't be like a college professor. So private school K through 12 seemed like something I could try without having to invest too heavily in pursuing other degrees, you know, which was something I was considering as well. But I decided to just, hey, let me send out some apps to some private schools and see what happens. So I wasn't entirely convinced that I was going to get any bites, just seeing as I really had no background in teaching. And so I sent applications out far and wide, all across the country, from LA to Maine. And I got a few interviews. And as I started kind of like just realizing that, oh, wait, wow, this might happen, I kind of started to get more excited about it and think, wow, wait, maybe this could be a really cool thing for me to do. And then I finally found McDonough, and they were the ones who were willing to give me a chance as, you know, someone, I give them a lot of credit for that, having no teaching credentials whatsoever. That was a leap of faith on their part as well as mine. And it worked out great. I met you we were neighbors the first year. I was very, very lucky to be placed in the classroom right next door to Steve Eno. What a serendipitous placement that was. You really helped me kind of get off the ground. I remember like the week before school talking to you like, Steve, how do you teach? Can you turn me into a teacher in 5 days?
Right.
And you gave me as much advice as, you know, as you could at that time. And I remember using just whatever I could grab onto and just hold on for dear life as those first couple of weeks of school unfolded. And I was just all of a sudden found myself with a classroom full of kids in front of me and absolutely zero training for what to do. So people like you and just the people who are just immediately around me were an incredible support system. And because of that really positive environment that I was in, I really found my footing. You know, took a little bit, but I very quickly kind of found that this was something that I really enjoyed doing. And saw that it was something that I could work on to become better at, and worked really, really hard on from there on out. You know, from that kind of first week, really, it was like, okay, I could do this. And I went for it. It's been great since.
Thank you for sharing that. And I'd love to double click on a few different things. But the first thing is that journey that you went on from a beginner teacher having no experience, no training, to the amazing teacher that you are today, and getting kind of a front row seat, getting to be next door to you, getting to watch the relationships that you built with students and the doors that you unlocked in their minds and mathematically for your students, even in that first year, was really something special. And there's something to be said about what you were able to do so quickly. And I'd love to dig into that a little bit. And sure. Get your thoughts on what do you think, like you said, you worked really hard at teaching that first year, at getting better. What do you think it was that helped you progress, helped you realize that you're doing something right, and allowed you to grow off of those wins that you had?
Yeah, that's a good question, because it was really, it was a lot of different things. And the first thing I guess I realized about teaching was that it's not all about being really good at explaining things. which is basically what got me there in the first place. I guess, you know, if I had I guess you could say my primary talent in teaching is that I figured out ways to break down complex ideas and just like explain things really well. And that was good. And that's what got me kind of to that point. But what I really was learning and had no idea was the other side of teaching, other than just the explanations themselves, how students digest those explanations is independent of the explanation itself. So you can explain something really well, but if the person you're explaining it to isn't primed to receive that explanation, it is as good as useless, right? And that was a very tough thing to learn how to do, because it's subtle and it varies from student to student, from class to class. But it really just became about learning how kids learn and how to make my explanations actually matter and make a difference, and kind of, you know, and not just my explanations, but the other things as well, right? Going then learning, okay, it's not at all about what I explain sometimes, it's about what you make them do, right? So there's this progression where I went from like, oh, all I got to do for teaching is explain things really well. And then I was like, oh, wait, no, that's not really enough. I got to make sure the kids are ready to hear that explanation. And then I was like, oh, wait, sometimes it's not about explaining anything. It's about just making them do something and arriving at their own sort of explanation. And then it just kind of kept developing from there. So I guess I started with kind of a very self-centered view of teaching, and it's just been gradually becoming way more realizing that it's really not about me at all, but about the students me guiding the students to their own revelations. And that, I believe, is, you know, that's how I approach teaching now. I try and do as little as possible in terms of directly kind of putting my hand on anything. And I try and make the students make their own discoveries at every opportunity. And that's the way I approach teaching today. And I still have so much room to grow in that respect, but I feel like over the past few years, I've kind of honed in on what my actual job is as a teacher, you know, and that's not obvious at all. You know, the people who are coming from the outside and someone had no teaching before, I never really realized that. And it took a lot of watching other teachers was really kind of what helped me realize this. I'm like, wait, they're not just giving good explanations all the time. They're doing much more subtle things on a deeper level that it takes a lot of careful observation to be like, oh my gosh, wow, that's how they got that kid to, you know, do X, Y, or Z. And what you and some of the other phenomenal educators at McDonough were a masterclass in those more subtle arts of teaching. A lot of it was just kind of mimicking what I was seeing from other educators. And then as I got the feel for it, developing techniques of my own.
That's amazing. And I know you think a lot deeper about these type of ideas and pretty much everything than most people. And that idea, and it's something that I've thought about with teacher training and onboarding, but that idea of going from a very egocentric teaching style, which I think is what a lot of people start out with, just because when we go through school, a lot of times that's most of what we experience as a teacher telling us what to do. And like, this is my class, this is how we're going to do it. But the best teachers are the ones who can get rid of that ego and do exactly like you said. Like, it's all about the students. It's all about their revelations. But it often takes teachers decades or a whole career to come up with that. So I'm curious, like, how are you able to think about that within a year? And like, yes, it took observation, but I'm also like a lot of our talk, I would love to dig into your thought process, because I think that is
dangerous territory.
I think that's what's really special. And I think what a lot of parents can learn from is like, how do you shed some of that ego? And how do you realize that that's really what's needed for kids to learn the best?
Yeah. You know, interestingly, I think it just comes from a place of really, really developing a way to see past my expertise, right? Like, I've obviously spent a tremendous amount of time thinking about math, and I have, you know, absolute fluency in mathematics. So it was really getting in the habit of not equating something making sense to me with something making sense to the students, right? That just doesn't happen. Right? We'd like to think that, oh, this makes sense to me, therefore it will make sense to you. So the first step to that was just realizing that I could not focus on just the things that made sense to me. That was something I started to realize when I was working at Mathnasium. So I was kind of already primed for that, I guess. So I guess part of why it happened so quickly was that was eroded slightly by the tutoring experience. But then, the tutoring, you're usually only working, even at Mathnasium, it's one-on-one most of the time. You're kind of one-on-one moving around the room, so to speak. But when I got into the classroom, it just became so incredibly obvious how that didn't translate, right? And so part of it, Steve, quite frankly, was just the first thing that helped me break down those walls were just all the blank stares I was getting in the room. All right, so there's a very direct, like, oh man, I just explained something that I thought made so much sense. And I'll actually tell you exactly what the first experience was, because I will never forget it. I was pre-calculus, I was teaching honors pre-calculus, and the first thing we were starting out with was just a review of functions and domain and range. And so like day one of class, we started talking about, well, I don't know if it was day one per se, but the first day of this lesson, just introduce the idea of a function again, and domain and range. Day two, I decided it was a great idea and made so much sense to talk about domain and range of function composition. So if you have two functions, they each have their own different domain and range. What's the domain and range of the composite function? And I just thought it was this beautifully elegant generalization of what we were doing the day before. Let's take it one step further. And I even had this really nice diagram, and I just thought it was the slickest thing on planet Earth. It could not have gone over worse. But it was just like, what? I mean, I think after that day, both me and the students went back to the drawing board, and I was like, uh-oh. and they were like, uh-oh. So that lesson was the first indicator, because I was so convinced that it was going to be this incredible lesson, and they were going to be in awe of the beauty of function composition and how it affects domain or range. And then when that didn't happen, and only not happen, but the exact opposite happened, I was like, oh boy, this is going to be harder than I thought. Yeah. So it took a lot of failures, quite frankly, just being faced with the question, why didn't that work? Mm. And I guess the part, my thought process, I'm slightly obsessed with figuring out why things don't work. Mm. I guess so that first, when something doesn't work for me, I guess over the course of my life, I got pretty good at dealing with failure and not really like getting too hung up on like me being bad. Like, oh, I messed something up, I must be bad. Like, I really focus on just like, why specifically? I want to know exactly why this didn't work. And I obsess over it. And so from that first kind of failed lesson, I really focused on why. And that's a hard question to answer, because to fully answer that question leads to this kind of year-long journey that you touched upon. And so it really just kind of kicked off from there, and I haven't really stopped thinking about why my lessons don't work.
That mindset is amazing. And I think a lot about like, how can I foster that mindset in my boys in terms of removing the stigma of failure. I've talked to my wife about this. She's like, one thing I never learned was how to fail. Like, she has gone through med school. She's done amazing things, valedictorian of her high school. But like, she tells me, like, I am really afraid to fail. And so we talk a lot about like, well, we need to like somehow teach our boys how to fail and how to have that mindset that you have in terms of, hey, I want to learn why it failed. I'm going to not feel bad about myself. I'm going to focus on the why and get better. I think I've told my wife, like, I learned that through skateboarding, I think, because you fall so much, you hurt yourself. There's that immediate feedback and things are hard. So you have to do them over and over and over and over again. But if you can figure out the why, it makes things a little bit easier. I'm curious, how do you think you built that mindset? Like, where do you think that mindset about failure came from, whether it be early in your childhood or whenever throughout your life?
Yeah, that's also a really good question. So I think my training ground, so to speak, in failure came from like a few different places. So first of all, I think the direct answer is that how you develop that mindset is from just high exposure to low stakes failures, right? Like, for kids, you must let them fail. You must let them fail often, but you must also not let their lives fall apart because of the failures. You know what I mean? So finding environments, like you had just mentioned, skateboarding. For me, I think video games were a big part of it. I was a huge gamer as a kid, but essentially find a place where you're going to fail over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, but in such a way that it's not like causing these horrible consequences for your life where you can't keep failing because you're now, you know, in some kind of bad situation. All right. So video games allowed me to fail thousands and thousands of times without anything actually bad happening to me in my life. I cared about it. I didn't want to fail in the video game. So there was that desire to succeed, but because there weren't any real ramifications, I went at it ad nauseum, right? Hours late into the night. And like, you know, so that was, you know, I was a little kid. That's one aspect of it. I think another aspect too, and I'll definitely give credit to my parents. They really, they fostered this mindset by also giving me low stakes opportunities to try something and potentially mess up. And one of those was working for my father. So my father is a small business owner. He has a company making acrylic lighting fixtures. And I would work for him as when I was younger. And eventually, once I got a little older, he started letting me take on more challenging work that I could mess up. You know, I was fabricating parts and I could screw them up, and I did. I would break parts, I would do them poorly, and I felt more pressure because it was, you know, they were real parts. These were going to real customers. They cost real money. And so, but he always managed it so I wasn't like potentially costing him, you know, $20,000 by messing up. So he would slowly kind of work my way up. And when I screwed up, he never, you know, made me feel really bad about it. It was like, okay, you know, don't do that again. Let's figure out how did you screw that up? And let's kind of figure out how we could change your workflow here so you don't keep repeating this mistake. And he was always so patient about it. And, you know, it upped the stakes slightly. Again, like I mentioned before, it wasn't the same as video games. This was a real deal. But so it was kind of like gradually increasing the stakes over my life, but still failing all the time. Right? I definitely messed up lots of parts working for my dad. You know, that's just the case over the years. But I kept doing it every summer. I would always spend my summer vacations, always at the factory, winter break sometimes, spring break. I would try, you know, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the work, and it was nice for me because I felt like I was doing something valuable finally. You know, I was really making real stuff. And yeah, so, and then, you know, that theme kind of continued through my life. So fail often, make sure it's in, you know, in a safe way, so to speak. Right. But that's also a knife edge, right? Because if the stakes are too low, there's not enough motivation to succeed. You know what I mean? Potentially. And it varies from kid to kid, you know, family to family. So this isn't some general statement, but I believe that's an important part of it, of dialing in the stakes just enough to light that fire, but not enough to create fear and anxiety, you know? And if you could kind of keep working that balance as they start to develop more resilience to failure, that, you know, over time will potentially produce this healthy mindset.
Yeah, that's an amazing, amazing, I guess, protocol or amazing way for parents to build that resiliency. I think that's, again, one of the biggest challenges as a parent and in our education system is to build that resiliency, that willingness to fail and learn. And so thank you for spelling that out. I'd love to dig in another part of your early childhood and talk a little bit about what got you so interested in math. Like, you are one of the most passionate people I've ever met about mathematics. And I'd love to go back to the beginning and find out, well, where did that start and how was it fostered and how did you just grow that affinity for mathematics?
So I have a slight advantage in that area. And I'll be the first to admit, I think I kind of had a leg up. When I was a kid, my mom is an educator and my dad's an engineer. That's their backgrounds. And so from a very early age, my parents were really on top of my education in a healthy way. But I never really struggled in math for a couple of reasons. My dad's engineering background, he really enjoyed math and he loved helping me with math when I was a kid. He really enjoyed it. It was never felt like overbearing, but he was just excited to do math with his kids, you know? And then my mom, having the education background, she really knew how to kind of best go about the learning side of things. And one of the most important things that she did, which I hated as a kid, was we did tons of summer work. Every summer, she would buy these books, math books, and we had summer homework, and that was to work through these books. And she used her teacher training to essentially make summer classes for us at home. And I wasn't allowed to go play until I did my work for the day. Drove me bananas as a kid. I hated it more than anything in the world. But it prevented me from falling behind. It stopped the summer slide dead cold. I don't think I ever summer slid ever. And so while that didn't necessarily make me a math prodigy from an early age, I never really struggled with it because they were always on top of it. That summer work, my dad helping out, just made sure that I never really had a very negative experience with math. So now that doesn't cut to, that doesn't kind of, you know, finish the rest of the story yet, right? Because that doesn't, not nothing remarkable to start with, but I think that was important. The fact that I never really had to kind of dig myself out of a hole in terms of viewing my math skills negatively. Like, they kind of started out neutral slash positive. You know what I mean? So that's why I say I feel like I had an advantage because I didn't really do it. That was not me at all. You know, that was just totally all my parents just like killing it in terms of early childhood education. So I take zero credit for that whatsoever. Where things started to change was when I was 10 years old. So this, we got to give props to my dad again. He was cleaning out his office one day, and he's been at this company. He started this company in the 70s when he was in his like late 20s. And let's just say, I don't think he's cleaned his office between then and that time when I was 10 years old. So he had all this stuff in his office from like, you know, the past, what was it? I guess 25, 30 years or so. And one of the things he took home as he was cleaning was a pile of his old college textbooks that had literally been sitting in his office that whole time. So he finally brought them home, and he like just came home and like put them on the table. You know, wasn't even, he just, whatever. He just emptied the car out. And just me walking around the house, I was just like, oh, look at this pile of dad's stuff. And I was looking through it and I found the books. And one of them was a calculus textbook. And I opened it and was absolutely spellbound. What I saw on those pages just entranced me like nothing I had ever experienced before as a kid. I just thought I was looking at like a spell book for wizards, you know, and the symbols and the diagrams just looked like magic to me. And I looked at my dad and I was like, do you understand this? And he was like, yeah. I was like, no freaking way. And I made him, I was like, all right, dad, you're going to explain this to me. And right then and there, we cracked open the book. I said, what's that symbol? What's that symbol? What's that? What's that? What's that? What's that? And I actually wrote a legend. I started writing them down in the front cover of the book. And I have the book to this day with this legend. I wrote down all the symbols and whatever he told me, I wrote it down. And I developed like a glossary because I wanted to know. I just wanted to know what it meant so bad. I didn't even care that it was math. Like, I was not even worried about how this related to addition and subtraction. It was just like, I must figure out these spells and I need to figure them out now. And from that day, I have been on that quest to kind of learn the spells, so to speak. I have never stopped craving to understand the next thing that I don't know. You know, that just set off a fiery passion for learning things that I, you know, I was like, oh my God, now that there's this other, there's, you tell me there's more math, there's other crazy books like this. And that was it. You know, from that point on, that lit the fire and I have not looked back since.
That is awesome. That is such a cool story. And I have another hypothesis that got me interested in math. And I just love your thoughts and your experience on it. Because I have a twin sister, so we were raised the same, similar gene set, obviously, but like our pathways diverged quite a bit, even in elementary school. And I've talked to my mom about this quite a bit in terms of like, what do you think caused like me to be so much more interested in math? And she used to always say like, my sister would get super frustrated because I'd come home with the same homework and I'd finish it in like 5 minutes and my sister would have to spend a couple hours like really learning and understanding the new math concepts. And I saw the patterns very quickly. And so my hypothesis is that I, for better or worse, I've played video games since I was about 4 years old. And like my earliest memory is literally sitting down watching my brother play the Super Mario Brothers 2 on Nintendo. And then I have played every video game since. And like, I always had to beat the video game. Like, I would never get a new video game or start the next video game until I beat it. And so my theory, just obviously with a twin sister, seeing how we diverged, like, video games is the one thing that I did that she didn't do. And so my hypothesis is that, like, I truly believe that video games helped me gain, whether it's pattern recognition, whether it's just spatial relationship. I don't know exactly what those early video games taught me, but I think they had a huge impact on my interest in math and my ability to learn new math, just because I could recognize patterns pretty quickly. I just would love your thoughts on that hypothesis, knowing that you have played video games since a young age as well, and maybe give hope for some parents who have kids who play video games all the time as well.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And there's been, gosh, I even remember from when I was a kid that there's all this debate on what effect video games have on kids, for better or worse. They turn them violent. No, they make them geniuses. No, they make them lazy. No, but right, everyone's got any kind of conclusion you can draw from kids playing video games, someone's drawn that conclusion and argued passionately for it, right?
Right.
And there's tons of literature out there. So I'm not going to assert any claims with any degree of expertise, because there's probably a research paper out there that will prove me wrong. So I will just, my feelings on it are that I think it definitely plays a role. And I think how is more important than what, right? So how are your kids playing video games? What are they playing? What are their thought patterns behind what happens in the video game? How do they handle failure? How are they approaching problems in the video games? Are they trying to be resourceful and problem solve strategically? Are they just kind of throwing things at the wall and seeing what sticks? Not that that's a bad thing, but just paying attention to those sorts of things. So my first recommendation to any parent who's concerned about this, I would say pay attention to your kid and how they're playing. Don't just say, oh, they're playing video games, and think that that experience is always the same, because it's definitely not. It varies wildly. And so I would say get invested in learning the games a little bit. Play with your kids. Figure out what exactly they're doing, what kind of challenges they're facing, how they're handling those challenges, how they handle defeat. And I think this experience can be molded based on that. You know, so there's not a one-size-fits-all answer that video games are good or video games are bad. I think, like anything else, it takes investment. And I think if the parents try, you know, express interest in it, I know it can be challenging. Not every parent, you know, is tech savvy or controller savvy. Like, I've been trying to get my wife into video games. And, you know, so just kind of, there's just those obstacles of like, you're better with a controller than I am, you know? And so sometimes, but it's great because I've been trying to pay attention to what she likes in video games. And we found a game that we both really like to play together, and that's Civilization. But it's like this one game. I've tried a bunch of different kinds of games, but for some reason, Civilization 6 is the one, right? So whatever. But that's because it took some time to like figure out what she would like with video games and what. But anyway, so my point being is, can be a positive experience, I think, but it's not passive, right? It can't just be like, oh, if I let my kids play video games, they'll be a genius, and I just got to set and forget. So unfortunately, the answer is yes, I think it can be beneficial, but it's probably going to be hard work to make sure it turns out that way.
That's, again, sage advice. And that whole idea of that wildly varying experience, I think that's something I've realized. It's like, it's so hard to say anything really works for every kid, because like how it's implemented with every kid and where the kid starts, like it's such a wide range that you, even with like recommendations to my friends, it's like, well, this works for me and my boys.
Right.
I don't know if it's going to work for you, but here's what I've found. And I think that's something in education that, again, has become a huge challenge, because it gets so prescriptive. Like, it has to work for everybody, or
nope.
We're going to throw it out. I'd love to go back a little bit to your time at Mathnasium, because mm-hmm. I think a lot of parents and kids have probably heard of it, but don't really know what it is. But more importantly, I'd love to get your thoughts, like what are the biggest lessons that you learned working at Mathnasium, and how has that kind of influenced your thinking about teaching kids mathematics?
So I have a very, I think I have an interesting answer to that, because I will say Mathnasium has been a wonderful thorn in my side as a teacher for one particular reason. What Mathnasium does so well is they have every kid moving at their own pace. Mathnasium has their own curriculum, and each student progresses through the curriculum at their own pace. They're progressing on their own individual track. When you start at Mathnasium, you're assessed as to where you're at. And it's not a totally linear track, I should say. It's not like, you know, an amusement park ride. There are, you know, different pathways, but, you know, they kind of diagnose each learner and figure out what you know, what you don't know, what your strengths and weaknesses are. And then you enter their curriculum, and then you are guided through that in on an individual basis. And that, I believe, is the secret to their success, because that's the way that I believe that math learning works. And I don't even want to say should work. That is the only way math learning works. You cannot progress past where you are at and expect any degree of success. And yet that is what we do in the American education system. So why I say it's been a thorn in my side is because ever since I started teaching in a classroom, I've been painfully aware of how superior the experience is when kids are progressing at their own pace, and seeing how hard it is to implement that in the classroom. So I never forgot that, and how powerful and transformative it was when kids were allowed to just learn at their own pace. And not being able to implement that classroom has been one of the most frustrating parts of my classroom teaching experience. And, you know, the things don't scale though. Like, we can't scale Mathnasium up to the national level and replace the education system. So it's like, we somehow have to find a way to make it work, but it's just been really hard. And I honestly have no idea, even to this day, what the answer is, how we can implement that in classrooms. It would take a radical restructuring of how public education works. So I don't really have an answer to that, but that experience at Mathnasium convinced me that that is what we need to aspire to, no matter how difficult it is, because it's just so ridiculously effective, you know? And then the other thing that Mathnasium also taught me was Socratic questioning, actually, and how to, kind of going back to what I was, you know, talking about earlier, how to guide students to their own conclusions and discoveries. But that only happens when they are confident in everything that came before, you know? So that has also been tough to implement in the classroom. I use that more on one-on-one. So that I use regularly when I'm working with students directly in small groups, or you know, when they come to me, you know, for extra help or whatever. I'm always drawing on those techniques that I learned and developed at Mathnasium. And I try and use them in the classroom as well. But, you know, that's also challenging, again, because it only works when they are comfortable with what leads up to it. You know, then the, like, Socratic questioning is a highly specific and targeted tool, right? It's not just this general thing that you do, right? It is an X-Acto knife, and it's got to be used in the right place at the right time, and then bam, you get the light bulb. But if it's not the right place and not the right time for that student, there will be no light bulb. And so sometimes when I do it in class, you could see, those kids, their light bulbs went off, it worked. But then these kids, there was something that, you know, for whatever reason, it didn't happen the way I imagined it would happen. So, but it's that also stuck with me too. And I believe is also extremely powerful. And there's more kind of behind, like, why does Socratic questioning work? I should probably maybe explain what it is for any listeners who don't know.
Yeah, I think that'd be helpful.
That just dawned on me as well. So Socratic questioning is essentially answering your question with another question, right? So if a student asks me, what is log base 2 of 8? I will not answer it for them. I will just ask them more questions, right? So Socratic questioning is something probably most people have experienced in their life. It's, you know, and perhaps is an annoyance to some people, all right? But it's also a very powerful teaching technique. So, okay, I'll do some basic Socratic questioning. Mr. Valente, what's log base 2 of 8? Well, let's back up. What's a logarithm, right? Let's just say, okay, first you tell me what a logarithm is. Well, a logarithm is this thing that's like the opposite of an exponent. Okay, so what does that mean about 2 and 8? When you say log base 2 of 8, what about the opposite of an exponent is being asked here? Well, something with a power of two. Okay, so then it goes on like this, right? But all I do, I never answer anything. Socratic questioning means you never provide an answer. The Socratic questioning is the absence of answering, and thus the student produces their own answer. And it can be very difficult to do, because as soon as you provide the answer, you have not done Socratic questioning, right? So you have to commit that I am not going to tell you the answer. And it could be, what's the word, frustrating at times. It could be frustrating for the student. It could be frustrating for the teacher. So, you know, it takes a lot of practice to make sure it is a non-frustrating experience. And that's why I compared it to an X-Acto knife, because you need to use it very skillfully at the right place at the right time, or else it will just lead to frustration.
That's a great reminder for me, because I definitely use that method, the Socratic method, a lot with my boys. And there's times where they're just like, Dad, can you just tell us the answer? Like, I was like, no, you know, I want to get your thoughts. I'm like, why did you ask this question? Where, like, what do you think? Like, tell me more about this. And yeah, there's definitely times where I overuse that tool, and where my boys are just like, Dad, we know, like, can you just tell us this one time? And so yeah, that's a great, great reminder. In terms of Mathnasium and those types of models, one critique that I've heard is, yes, it enhances the skill of students, but sometimes it creates, like, for lack of a better term, like a math robot, where they can do the work, they can move forward quickly, but sometimes it takes that magic out of math. I'm curious, out of your time at Mathnasium, do you think there were those moments that you had where you're like, what, like, I need to know these spells, I need to go to the next level? How often do you think that happens at math, or is it kind of like, kids after school, their parents are forcing them to do this, it's more work, and they're just like kind of grinding through it, like, all right, I'm just going to keep going. And then by the time they get in college, and I've known some students like this, brilliant, like years ahead mathematically, and then they're like, you know what, I'm going to stay as far away from math as possible, and I'm going to major in, I don't know, creative writing or something like that. And so how do you think Mathnasium is handling that aspect of pushing forward?
Yeah. So part of it is that Mathnasium just attracts a very diverse student base, right? We really actively promote, well, I say this present tense, you know, I know the company actively promotes that they are, they're a good fit for every math learner, whether you are, you know, really struggling and have significant, you know, gaps in your background, or you're, you know, doing all right, but you need a little extra, or students were really far ahead and were bored to tears and needed extra stimulation. And we had the full spectrum of students. So the experience definitely depended on why they were coming to us in the first place. And we definitely had, you know, some of those students were just there because they liked math and they just had a huge appetite for it. And, you know, perhaps the parents felt that their, you know, their classroom experience wasn't filling that desire, so we did. It depended a lot on who they were working with. So again, just for listeners to get a better idea of Mathnasium, you know, model, what happens is the students come in, there's a, you know, a usual, you know, a group, a larger group of students, let's say, you know, 18 to 20 in the learning center at a time. And then there's a smaller number of instructors trying to maintain a certain ratio. I forget exactly what it was actually, but let's say 3 to 1, three students per one instructor. And so the instructor would go around and work with students, and you're constantly alternating between independent practice and working with an instructor. So a student would request assistance. I would come over, see what they needed, you know, work with them, and then set them back on independent work. And then that frees me up to go work with another student. So it's kind of like a dance where all the instructors were always making sure that, you know, kind of strategically that every student, you know, is working on something, that they're all having their needs met. It was a very challenging job, but really fun. I loved it. It was just like, it was one of the most entertaining things I've ever had to do. You know, it was like a math, I don't know, not competition. Yeah, math ballet. Like, I just got to go and just kind of float around the room and just talk about calculus and then teaching a 7-year-old how to add. And, you know, it was just like, I was running the full math curriculum all day, every day. And it was just like absolutely a delight. So, but anyway, going back to your original question, you know, I think it definitely depends on who they're working with too. You know, it's on the instructors to inspire the kids. Part of my job was to get them excited about math, not just answer their questions, but it was really, I felt it was my responsibility to make them feel that interest. You know, so it does depend a little on who exactly you get. And that's just kind of one of the, but that's true with all teachers, right? Some teachers just click with students and some are harder to relate to. That's just the nature of being a teacher, right? It's your personality and that comes through. And that doesn't necessarily mean anything about the quality of the teacher. That's just the way people are, right? So it definitely, the short answer is it can really inspire kids to love math. I absolutely believe that. And I believe that a huge thing, something that goes towards accomplishing that is removing the fear and anxiety that comes with math. I think for some students, the only obstacle to them loving math is their fear of it. And when they start succeeding in math and they lose that fear and anxiety, they naturally develop an appreciation and love for it. That doesn't always happen. And then there are some kids who have just been really traumatized by things that have happened in their education, usually not because of the math itself. Like doing poorly on a math test caused them, you know, to be shamed by a teacher or something in front of the class, and they had this awful experience, and you know, where whatever it was that they got a bad grade, and somehow the teacher told the class whatever, and then they're just traumatized for life, right? Oh my god, that one experience. And then that really causes issues, you know, that sort of thing can really scar a child. And then they see it as like because of math, but really it's just this overall bad experience that was caused by whatever math was. And yeah, so anyway, so there's a whole spectrum, and I believe it can work for most kids. Their own attendance was a factor as well. Mathnasium was one of those things you have to commit to. The most successful students were the ones who showed up the most regularly and really, you know, committed to it. So, you know, there were some that were frustrated and felt like what we were doing wasn't working, but you know, you just pulled up their attendance, like, yeah, because you only come like once a month. So it's not like, again, it's not a set and forget sort of thing. You don't just drop your kid off and then they magically come out math wizards. It's a commitment. It's a grind. Depending on where they are at, it might take a while for there to be results, but it works. Like I remember one of the students that I saw the biggest transformation with. I started working with her right when she was one of the first students I worked with. She was a sophomore in high school at the time and really had very, very significant challenges with math going way back. I mean, she was a, you know, sophomore in high school, but she was kind of working on the same stuff that some of the fifth and sixth graders were working on. And, you know, that was kind of difficult because she could see that. She knew what she was working on, and she knew that kid over there was working on the same thing. And that was really tough, but she was committed. And we, you know, she would just like had such a great attitude about it. And she just kept coming and kept coming for the whole time that I worked there. She just was so dedicated. And by the time I left, she was a senior and she was in calculus and she was killing it. She just really completely turned her math life around. It took a few years. It really did. You know, the duration of my employment is how long it took her to go from fifth grade math to calculus. And she came like three times a week, every single week, and completely transformed. I mean, the student that I saw when I left there and the student that I met at the beginning were totally different people. And it was because of her dedication over time. You know, so it's not a quick fix, but it really can work.
Yeah, that's an awesome story. And yeah, a great example of, like you said, that hard work and how far a student can come. And unfortunately, it also shows how our school system allows that kind of gaps to happen and build up over time. And I know we've talked a lot about that. But before we dig into that a little bit, I'd love to talk a little bit more about some of the tools that you use in your classroom. Specifically, I'd love to start with games and board games. And if you could explain to our listeners, why do you set like classroom days for kids to play games? And how do you think that's important for learning math?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So as you know, Steve, this is one of my personal favorite strategies in the classroom because it's a wonderful trick. You know, really what I'm doing is, you know, accomplishing something by making them think that we're not doing what we're doing. Right? Like, oh guys, we're gonna be playing games today. Like, we're not really learning. We're just playing games. Like, oh, okay, it's a fun day. Woohoo, no learning, right? But really, that's when the best learning happens, right? Secretly. And I really very strongly believe that having fun while you're learning is one of the most critical parts of really learning something. So I actually just opened up my classes this year, my virtual classes, with a game. We played Towers of Hanoi. And I did this for all of my classes, actually. I have an advanced algebra class, so it's algebra 2, basically, mostly freshmen and sophomores. And I also teach multivariable calculus to seniors. And we did the same thing. We started out my class, we all played Towers of Hanoi, both the algebra class and the calculus class, because this simple game, so again, for anyone who's not familiar with the Towers of Hanoi, it's really just a stacking game. You just have a certain number of discs, and that number can vary. You have three posts, and you have a pile of discs on one post, and the whole object of the game is to move that pile to another post. The only restriction is that you can only move one disc at a time, and you can never put a bigger disc on top of a smaller disc. And they're in descending size. If you have seven discs, each one will be smaller than the next. So you'll have, it would be like a little pyramid. And that's what I call it, like the towers kind of looks like, I guess, historically what the towers in Hanoi look like. I'm not very good with history, but that's kind of my understanding. That is visually representative of how they look. But anyway, so a very simple game, very old game. You could teach it to a kid in, 30 seconds. However, if you really try and fully solve the game, it leads you down a rabbit hole that can go to very high levels of math. If you actually were to fully kind of explore it and just then don't stop and just keep going and pushing it further and further and further, you actually arrive at a connection to the Sierpinski triangle. So Towers of Hanoi is connected to a complete walk in a Sierpinski triangle somehow, right? And that's kind of where my seniors could go and get into some really, but it all starts with this simple game. So usually what games are doing, they're a very fun way of disguising some really serious mathematics. And so I love to trick my students into this high level thinking by making them think that they're not learning anything. It's beautiful, right? Because I essentially get my best lessons when they think they're not doing a lesson at all. And then fun's the other key. When they are smiling and laughing and enjoying themselves, they're the most open to real inspiration and real learning. When I say learning, I'm talking about neurons changing. Like, I'm talking rewiring of the brain. I don't consider memorizing a fact learning, right? When if a kid can regurgitate the quadratic formula to me, I don't necessarily think that they've learned it. Okay, you have parroted something to me. You have done something that a bird can do. Good. Okay, next, let's make sure you understand what that means. So when I refer to learning, that's what I'm actually talking about, is real understanding. And that happens when they are feeling good. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I agree with you wholeheartedly about the use of games. And for a parent who obviously doesn't have your math background, and even for me sometimes, like, I'm playing chess with my boys, I'm playing Settlers of Catan, I play tons of games. You can see our rack behind me.
Yeah.
Whether it be from Risk or Quiddler, just whatever game we're playing, I always try to have them think about like the math concepts. And we do puzzles. I told you about a book that I use around math puzzles. Yes. Every day with my boys. Even sometimes it's hard for me to like realize all of the math that is in the games, but also like finding the connection that my boys can best relate to, that sometimes can be a challenge. And so I'm curious, how do you go about helping kids make that connection to the game they're playing, to either a specific math or whatever math they're ready for? Do you have any recommendations for that for me or for our other parents?
So I'll tell you one of the things I did two years ago now, when I was at McDonough and I would have these game days, these game sessions, I would make them do a reflection at the end. And I could pull up, I had the sheet somewhere, but it's not really important. But yeah, I asked them some questions about the experience. And I specifically just asked about, like, did you have a strategy? Like, first of all, do you have any strategy at all? Or were you just kind of doing random things? And sometimes that they would say, like, yeah, I had no strategy whatsoever. I was just kind of playing what I felt like. And say, okay, that's fine. So, okay, what about next time? Are you going to continue to do that? Are you going to just kind of do things randomly again? Maybe, maybe not, And what you kind of realize is that games aren't a whole lot of fun when you're just randomly doing things that you don't really understand, right? And they get tired of it pretty quickly. So if you kind of just do it repeatedly, they'll kind of eventually get to a point where they're either going to not want to play the game anymore, or they're going to want to dig deeper because otherwise it's just going to be boring, right? And sometimes it's just about doing that repeatedly until they find the game that really gets them going, right? They might have to go through several of these. And when I was at McDonald's, I would save these sheets. You know, they would submit them to me. And sometimes you would see a kid who would just never really was into the game that they were playing. I would get one game report and I was like, yeah, it wasn't whatever. Didn't really have strategy. Don't really like this game. Okay, another game report. Same thing. Another game report. Same thing. I had a bunch of games, so they would have a lot of options. And then finally, bam, they found the game that really fired them up. No idea why. It's just that this one particular game really clicked with them, and then it just started to flow. And they're like, oh, well, I noticed this, and I noticed this. And I didn't do anything as a teacher. I just kept making them play games, right? Like this, I didn't really have to do much other than make them play games and ask them questions about it at the end, and then just be patient. And eventually, almost every kid eventually found a game that got them really thinking critically and analyzing. And every kid had a different game that they drew, you know, what they were drawn to. And I couldn't have predicted it either. Like there wasn't necessarily anything about the game that I was like, oh yeah, that kid totally would be into that game. A lot of times I was surprised. I was like, oh, okay, you like Chinese checkers? Sure, go nuts, right? Like I wasn't gonna get in the way of what they liked. I actually remember one in particular, three of my students in my pre-calculus class were playing Chinese checkers and their game reports were absolutely fascinating. They were comparing their strategy to military tactics in the American Indian Civil War. Sorry, again, my history is absolutely terrible, but they learned about this in history class recently, again, whatever it was, and for some reason, the tactics that were used there that they learned about in history is what they were trying to do in Chinese checkers, and they were talking about it. And I was like, this is so freaking cool. I didn't tell them to do that. I don't even know what they're talking about because my history isn't very good, you know, but it caused me to go do some research. I was like reading this report. I'm like, oh man, I got to learn about this war. And so I did. I was like, oh my God, they're right. Like it was just, I learned something. It was just such a cool experience and it just happened organically. And so, yeah, I don't really have a special sauce for it other than just there's so much variety out there. There's got to be something that your kid's going to be into. It just takes a lot of experimenting.
Yeah, that's awesome advice. And I think a lot of parents that I talk to get scared because like, I don't know how to do this. But like you said, sometimes it's just giving your kids exposure to a lot of different things, finding what they're interested in, and then doing some research on the back end and be like, all right, I'm going to learn about this game, the math behind it, whatever it is. And then that opens up doors for so much more. So yeah, that's awesome. Awesome advice. Kind of continue that thread of fun and learning. You created one of the most popular clubs, McDonough. And I remember constantly going by your classroom and seeing a packed house and students were just listening to you and some other teachers talk and have debates about high level thinking concepts. And so could you describe that club and like tell why you think students were so interested in that particular club?
Yeah, great. So great question. And actually, I'm going to go back to the story I was talking about before with my dad's calculus textbook. That feeling of earth-shattering wonder, I think, is one of the most important feelings to maintain in children. And I actually use that word maintain deliberately because I believe all children have that in them, right? That if we don't mess it up, the students, kids have this deep sense of wonder about the world. And it tends to be beaten out of them by the world, right? So every kid has this in them that if they just kind of see the right thing, they're like, oh my God, I need to know what that is. It's like, I've heard this analogy. It's like a unicorn in the wilderness. Like imagine you're walking through the forest and you just see, you catch a glimpse. You're like, was that a freaking unicorn? But it runs off and you're like, I got to go after, I got to see if that was a unicorn. So you go chase and then he keeps always running around the corner from you and you're just like trying to find it. But you're like, I could swear that I saw this magical creature and you're just possessed by this desire to like find it, right? That's kind of what I felt about calculus. I saw this unicorn in the wilderness and I needed to see it, you know, and I needed to understand it and know what it was. And so that was basically what I was trying to do with this club. So it's called The Art of Thinking. And really what I was aiming at was not to necessarily fully teach kids about the things I was talking about. I would talk about things that were way, way beyond what high school students learn ever. Okay. I had things about Gödel's incompleteness theorem, quantum computing, theories of consciousness, like totally inappropriate for high school students. Okay. but the way I did it was in a way that I wasn't actually trying to fully teach them Gödel's incompleteness theorem. I didn't fully do the proof. We didn't talk about Gödel numbering or like any of those things. Okay. What I did was I just tried to capture the essence of why Gödel's incompleteness theorem is one of the most staggering achievements of the human intellect and coax a sense of mystery. So ironically, I don't think I really taught anything during those times. I just created a sense of this deep, deep wonder. I gave them little glimpses of the unicorn in the wilderness. And that's all I had to do. And that's why it was so popular, because they were just enraptured by the mystery and the fact that it remained a mystery even after they left the room. And that's what I was deliberately trying to cultivate, you know? So, you know, quantum computing, it's this crazy, crazy idea. And yeah, there's no way I could fully teach quantum computing to high schoolers, but I can get high schoolers super fired up about it and then take a bunch of college classes and learn quantum computing, right? And yeah, and so I was really just trying to recreate what happened to me as a kid, you know? And it was just so formative. You know, my whole life was basically just changed by this book, and just, it's calculus, actually. Like, I mean, I ended up teaching calculus. Now I know it's not, you know, like, it's not actual wizard spells. Well, that could be debated. Some people, sometimes it is a bit like wizardry, what mathematics can do, you know, but that to me is so important. And whether you think they can do it or not is not important, right? I think there's this sense of like, oh, you can't teach high school, it's too sophisticated, or like these ideas are too complex and blah, blah, blah. Shut up. Like, just tell them about it anyway. Get them excited. And whether they can actually do it or not, like, is not important. What you need to do, and I feel I have a responsibility as an educator, is to not squash that natural sense of wonder and curiosity that children have. And to, by the time they get to high school, unfortunately, it has been a little bit. So I was trying to kind of reignite that in those kids before it totally goes out in college. You know, it's like, oh no, this is my last chance to reignite that flame before lecture halls and final exams put it out forever. So it was like my last ditch effort to kind of keep that sense of wonder going into adulthood, you know? So that might sound ridiculous, but that was essentially what I was doing.
Yeah, no, I think that's amazing. And like that mission, and I would love to get your thoughts on this, like that to me is probably the most important thing that we can do for kids. Like when I homeschool my boys, like everyone's like, well, what curriculum do you use? Like how much time do you spend doing kill and drill type of tasks? I'm like, I try to stay as far away from that stuff as possible. Like I purposefully leave time in our day where my boys can just ask questions. They can just explore. Like we see something on YouTube, like my wife was making slime with my boys and she's like, oh, go ask your dad about the chemical, like the chemistry behind slime and why it works. And so we got into some of the different chemical compounds that we're using. But in the end, I was like, I think it's a good time to introduce you to the periodic table. And like, what are some of these base elements that are combining in these different structures to create that new slime material? And so we find a periodic table song and they literally say, Dad, can we listen to the periodic table song every day? And I'm like, sure. And it's a cool song. It basically just goes through all of the elements in the periodic table, why it's organized the way it is, and what every single element is used for. And so like that wonder, that idea where they're like, wait, you're telling me that all of this stuff that we use is made out of these small elements that can be organized in a table? And like, if I were doing school the way that it's prescribed, my boys would not see the periodic table until high school. Now they're a 7 and a 9-year-old who's super fired up about this world that is created by these elements. And to me, that wonder, that one moment is worth whatever we lose in ramming ideas down their throat or in their head. That is way more important to me. You had to do that in a club, which was, again, an optional thing outside of class. School is geared toward tests, toward scores. The entire system is almost geared to pull that wonder out of kids. Yep. And to focus elsewhere. How do you think we can either change what we measure or change the focus, or at least make sure that a majority of kids don't lose that wonder? Do you think that's possible, or do you think that would take a completely revamping of what we do?
Yeah, I think unfortunately the short answer is that the deck is stacked against wonder and largely, at least for K through 12 education, specifically in America, the college is a really, really, really big factor that I have seen in my experience, particularly working in the private school world, that the goal seems to be just getting into an Ivy League, that like everything that they do in their lives up to the age of, you know, 18 or 17 or 18, that it's all just to go to Harvard. But like, what's the point of going to Harvard then? Right? Like, what's the point of going to college? I believe the goal should be to instill wonder and curiosity about the world and whatnot, but it's all just so dominated by college. Now, I could give you a good example of that. So this year, before the Towers of Hanoi thing, literally the very, very, very first day of meeting my students, I did an icebreaker. And I thought of a new icebreaker that I've never done before, but perfectly illustrates this problem. I asked each student to just say their name and then give me something interesting about themselves that they can't put on a college application. And there was significant difficulty in doing that because they so heavily identify with the things that are ultimately just getting them into college. I play soccer. I do piano. I play piano. Like all the things they would normally say, it's all just stuff that they're doing because it's like they think that they should be doing it because it looks good for college. And if I get into MIT, my life will be set, right? This is the lie that they've been fed. And it's so unfortunate. It's so sad. So yeah, education's just been gamified and just turned to this competition of who can get into Harvard and MIT and whatnot. And it's like, it's grotesque to a degree, you know, that I'm like, oh my God, this is not the point. And so how do you break that? I don't really know. I think it's got such a stranglehold, the college obsession and the Ivy League. So the college obsession in general is one thing. And then like particularly private schools are obsessed with Ivy League. So I don't, you know, like, you know, I'm speaking from the private school world. So I don't, you know, that's not necessarily everywhere, but that general idea kind of is. And so I don't really have a solution other than, you know, kind of being that unicorn in the wilderness. Like educators who are about this, like what I'm talking about, tend to unfortunately be in the minority. And so just being, increasing our visibility, like the Art of Thinking was, you know, at this club, you say it was optional, but it was my platform to kind of put myself out there. It's like, hey kids, I stand for something different. My goals as an educator are really not what you might have experienced before. And so that was how I was kind of able to advertise my philosophy towards education. It kind of comes from the fact that I was never trained as a teacher. So I kind of came into teaching with fundamentally different goals than one might come into teaching after having gone through, you know, gotten a teaching certificate and taken the praxis and like, you know, whatever. I'm not disparaging anyone who has done that, but like I was never conditioned to think of my goals as an educator as anything but what I felt like they should be. And having my background, I was like, well, my goal is to make you feel this sense of wonder that perhaps has not been given the service that it deserves over the course of your education. Did I answer your question? I'm not even sure.
Yeah, no, you did. I figured, again, there's no easy answer to fixing with the school system. But yeah, I think just your answer in terms of being that unicorn, being that inspiration, that's all any teacher and all of us can do until we can hopefully create a system around all of those unicorns and get them, give them the ability to have a larger platform and an ability to reach more students. And so hopefully we can get there. I know we're already going over time, but I'd love to I'd love to at least get to one more question. And you have taught a lot of upper level math courses and as well as upper level computer science courses. And so computer science is a huge focus, a huge interest for families and kids. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on what are the connections between math and computer science, and how have you found I guess, continued inspiration in applied mathematics, not just theoretical mathematics, and looking at technology on a broader level.
Mm. Yeah, that's a field that's really been evolving a lot lately. The intersection between math and computer science. And I was just, I think it was yesterday or the day before, I learned that Texas Instrument now has a Python edition of their TI-83 or TI-84 calculator that has Python on board. It uses a version of Python meant for microcontrollers. So they've managed to put Python in a calculator, which I thought is awesome. I knew there was a calculator called NumWorks. It was totally unrelated from Texas Instrument, came out a couple of years ago that did this, that had Python in a calculator. But now that Texas Instrument is doing it, that is really bringing it into the mainstream. And it's a huge move. And I was unaware of that. I don't actually know when exactly that happened. It must be recent. And so I was really excited about that because I think there's tremendous, tremendous value in using computer science as a platform to teach mathematics and just as a creative outlet in and of itself. So there's kind of two sides to this debate. There's the should every kid learn to code debate, and then there's the does coding belong in math class debate, and they're different. So I could speak a little bit to both, having done a lot of work in both fields. I'll say something that's, I think, slightly controversial. I don't necessarily think that every single student ought to take a computer programming class, not like in a sense that they should be like forced to, just like how they ought to take like history and whatnot, simply because the point of computer science and programming, it's a tool to make something, right? I want to do this. Oh, well, you can write a program to do that for you, right? I think if you remove the end goal, like, oh, there's a thing I want to make, and you take that away and you're just learning to code for coding's sake, it takes all the fun out of it, right? Like, I learned to code. Actually, I'll tell you my beginnings of learning to code. It's kind of funny because it started out with calculators. In high school, we had the TI-83s, and back then, this was in the early 2000s, the TI-83s had a very primitive programming language on them based on the old programming language called BASIC. So this is a very old school programming language, and then Texas Instrument kind of adapted it to fit on their calculators, just like how they did with Python, except this was just with a really old programming language that had a lot of archaic structures to it, and that's what was on there. And so most kids didn't know that because it was really kind of hard to learn and whatever, so it was very obscure. Anyway, one of my buddies in high school learned this, and he wrote this program that tricked you, that essentially if you ran it on your calculator, it would look like your calculator is working normally, but your answers were always off by a little bit. So it would like subtract 0.01 from, I don't know, whatever. But it just messed with your calculator. So you would put things in and it would give you the wrong answer. And if you weren't clever enough, you wouldn't realize that your calculator was giving you all wrong answers. So he would like borrow someone's calculator, put this program into it, give it back to them, and they wouldn't know what happened. And then all of a sudden their calculator would be giving them incorrect answers. So, so he did this to me and he pranked me. And I was like, ha ha ha, how'd you do that? Tell me exactly how you did that. I want to know. And so I interrogated him into teaching me how to program on the calculator so then I could do this prank to other students. So for me, the end goal was basically being able to do a prank, and programming was a means to that end. Okay. Now, that was a very silly story, but that essentially carried me through with programming. Because like, oh, wait, programming, I could do fun stuff with this. And then I started writing other programs on my calculator in BASIC. And for those of you who are familiar with BASIC and TI programming, this is a very ridiculous thing to do, right? Actually typing on a calculator and writing programs on the TI-83 takes an inordinate amount of time. But I was hell-bent on pranking my friends. So I did, and I actually really dug into it and learned. But for me, programming always was a means to an end. And that's not to degrade what programming is, but that is what it is, right? Like, programming always accomplishes something. So I think, unfortunately, what happens, like, in these, by forcing everyone to take programming classes, they don't necessarily want to program yet. They don't necessarily have a desire to create something that programming is the solution for. And so when you do that, you can very quickly kill any interest in programming by doing it without there being a desire for programming to begin with, right? it stuck with me because I wanted it. I wanted to pull pranks on my friends. So I wanted to learn to program, right? And there's a deep motivation. And I endured the grueling task of programming on a TI-83 because I just loved pulling pranks, right? And so it was worth the hard work for me. So this is all to say, if a student has this in, you know, not even an interest in computer programming, but if there's something they're interested in that you can create a program for, that is a great way to start computer programming. Like your boys, they are into Minecraft, I believe, right? From our previous, yeah. So that's an amazing motivation to use programming for. Like Minecraft mods are one of the best ways to get kids into programming because it's part of the video game. It's like, right. Oh, hey, you know the thing you've been wanting to build in Minecraft? Well, you know, if you learn Java, you can do that. They'd be like, wait, whoa. Okay, where do I learn Java? Tell me, right? But that's because they're already into Minecraft, right? Like, if a kid doesn't care about Minecraft at all, then that's not really a good hook for them. So, you know, that's like one way of going about it. Now, going back to your question about math in the classroom, that's a totally different story. So, because you can use math, that provides the motivation, right? If you're using computer programming in math class, ostensibly through the math lesson, you would already have the motivator there, right? Like this, you know, whatever problem you've gotten them excited about, and then you sneak the programming in as an additional tool to look at that problem or to introduce a new intuition or like, you know, concept or whatever. And I think there's really tremendous value in doing that because you can really create some very rich analogies like functions. When I'm teaching functions in advanced algebra and whatnot, I really want to like do programming with them. I would love to do coding as a way to explore functions more and deepen that intuition for functions. And it could serve like a totally different role than just like in a pure computer science class. So yeah, basically there's totally room for both. I think it needs to be used skillfully and not just thought of as like, oh, every kid should learn to program and it's going to turn them into geniuses and they'll work in Silicon Valley and make tons of money. No. Like, it's got to be way more thoughtful than that.
I love that connection that you said in terms of math problems being inspiration for programming. I don't know if you've heard of Project Euler.
Yes.
Yeah.
Love it. Project Euler.
Yeah, that was definitely one of the tools that I use to challenge students to learn new programming constructs and ideas, and then to also be inspired by really interesting math problems along the way. Thank you for that. I'd love to close. I know we're already a little bit over, but close with one more question. You've given us amazing insights. Having been through a couple of different schools and seeing the current state of affairs in education, if you had ultimate authority, if you had the magic wand,
God forbid,
what would you change about the general structure of school? What would you do to help more kids either love math or just be successful in life in general?
That's actually easy. I know exactly what I would do. There's just no way I would allow, uniform paced classes anymore. I think that's an abomination. I think that's antithetical to learning. And I think that putting 20 kids in a room and expecting them all to learn at the same pace is just a fool's errand. It's how education's worked for a long time because of just the necessities of, well, here's the teacher and here's a bunch of kids and like you got to bring them together. But I think technology today allows us to finally break out of that. And I think we're in a position that we could potentially have more individualized learning. And that would be my holy grail. Like going back to what I was saying about Mathnasium, how that's been a thorn in my side, because that's been, to me, the model of successful math learning. And the key is that it's individually paced. And if we could do that in the classroom, that would be amazing. And that's not to say that I should think that every kid is learning alone. That's the exact opposite. Like, okay, think of it a bunch of, all right, just imagine, okay, this is a very poor analogy, but like, imagine that math, everyone's running on a track and you have all the different lanes on the track, right? And then, you know, what we're forcing right now is everyone must run at the same pace. And if you fall behind, run faster. And just, we're all running exactly, you know, shoulder to shoulder, all in our different lanes. And that's classroom learning, right? And we just make it work just by sheer willpower, okay? that's absurd, right? We should just allow every kid to run at their own pace, and they're never going to be alone because someone's always going to be passing by them, right? Someone else may come from behind. They might be running faster than you, and that's fine, whatever. They're running faster than you right now. Who knows whether that's going to be true later on, but that's who you're working with at that moment. So I think individualized learning could ironically provide some of the richest group learning possible, because you're going to be working with whoever's kind of in the same realm as you at that moment, and then they move on or you move on, and then you're working with someone else. And I think that there's going to be this beautifully collaborative yet individualized way of bringing kids together to all learn at their own pace, but yet learn with whoever you're kind of with at the time. And that would, yeah, if I had a magic wand and I was, you know, the boss of you know, schools everywhere, I think working towards that could be the future of how schools could work. Whether that's actually going to happen, I don't know. But like, yeah, that to me is what technology enables today. I think it's totally possible. We have the tools, we have the expertise, we have the knowledge. It's just a matter of making it happen.
That's awesome. And I can't think of a better way to end on that positive note on what education can be. And so thank you so much for your time, for your wisdom.
Thank you, Steve.
And I'm excited to have many, many more of these conversations in the future.
Thank you for listening to the Learning Pod Network. If you'd like more information about our offerings and services, please go to www.impactconnections.org. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at ImpactConnectED. We will also be releasing our weekly newsletter called Teaching Tuesday every Tuesday, where you'll get a summary of all of our latest information and resources that we have found as we explore the best practices of learning pods and education during COVID-19. So thank you, and we hope you'll join us next week. Take care, be well, and teach together.